Here's to the moment, to the places that give you perspective and the people that change that perspective. Embrace limitless discovery on a Silver Sea voyage with savings of up to 40%. Book between December 3rd, 2025 and February 28, 2026 at silversea.com. Here's to having every reason to celebrate, to finding more. Terms and conditions apply. Selected voyages and fare categories. For full terms and conditions, visit silversea.com/limitlessdiscovery.
At Aberdeen Investment Trusts, we create more ways for your money to work harder. Whether you're looking to tap into global markets or target specific goals at any stage of life, we have options for you. With Aberdeen, our investment knowledge and experience become yours. Search Aberdeen Investment Trusts online to learn more. When investing, please remember that your capital is at risk.
Issued by Aberdeen Fund Managers Limited.
And now, for your listening pleasure, something unexpected from Currys.
All right, who's put thousands of white doves in my Currys store?
Me, boss, to promote our care and repair service. Good, innit?
What?
Well, you said care and repair was magic, so doves.
I said, if you take out a care and repair plan when you buy tech from Currys, we'll fix it fast if it breaks down, like magic. Are those rabbits?
It's okay, the tiger will take care of them.
Care and repair at Currys. Is it really magic or just beyond expectations?
Excludes accidental and cosmetic damage. T's and C's apply.
Turkey tummy. Fizzy reflux. Sprouts. Gastric trouble can feel like the festive gift that keeps on giving. At the first sign of discomfort, think Pepto-Bismol.
When you have nausea.
Heartburn.
Indigestion.
Upset stomach.
Diarrhea.
Pepto-Bismol coats and soothes your stomach for effective five-symptom relief. Pepto-Bismol oral suspension contains bismuth subsalicylate. Always read the label.
Merry Christmas. With the news on Times Radio, I'm Laura Cook. The Princess of Wales was inundated with hands wishing her and the royal family a Merry Christmas at Sandringham. They met crowds on the Norfolk estate after attending their traditional church service. Andrew Mountbatten Windsor wasn't there after being stripped of his prince title, though his daughters, Princesses Beatrice and Eugenie, were invited. These well wishers enjoyed the morning.
We saw King Charles, we shook his hand, Princess Anne talked to us. It was wonderful.
I suppose the Queen, and I gave her one of the calendars that I produced with Royal Images. She was very pleased with that.
2.5 hours of waiting was well worth it.
Yeah, it's better than waiting for a football match.
Pope Leo XIV has been addressing crowds at St. Peter's Square at the Vatican. The first American pope is leading his first Christmas since being elected 7 months ago.
On this day of celebration, I wish to send a warm and fatherly greeting to all Christians, especially those living in the Middle East, whom I recently visited on my first apostolic journey. I listen to them as they express their fears and know well their sense of powerlessness before the power dynamics that overwhelm them.
In his first Christmas Mass, the leader of the World Roman Catholics made an unusually direct condemnation of the plight of Palestinians in Gaza. Alina Trabatoni is a journalist in Rome.
Well, midnight Mass last night certainly set the tone. He kept the liturgy quite simple and traditional, restoring quite a bit more Latin chant, but preaching a short homily that focused on ordinary families struggling with the cost of living, on children caught up in wars from the Ukraine, the Middle East, and so forth.
The Church of England is having its second Christmas in a row without an active Archbishop of Canterbury. This time last year, Justin Welby had withdrawn from public duties after resigning over an abuse scandal. Dame Sarah Mullally will take on the role at the end of January. The Times religious affairs correspondent Kaya Burgess explains who's filling the interregnum.
The most senior figure in the church remains, for now, the Archbishop of York, Stephen Cottrell, who will deliver a Christmas Day sermon at York Minster. Mullally, still in her role as Bishop of London, will deliver her own at St Paul's Cathedral. But she will, I understand, be delivering the traditional New Year's Day message via the BBC in her role as Archbishop-elect of Canterbury. It is usually reserved for a message of hope, but she already faces quite a challenge in offering hope at a time of great division, both in the wider world and in her own church.
Donald Trump has promised not to let a bad Santa infiltrate the United States. The American president and the First Lady continued a White House tradition by calling children across the country last night and asking them what they'd like for Christmas. Turkish prosecutors say they've detained more than 100 people suspected of links to the Islamic State group. Pistols and ammunition were seized, police say, in a series of raids in Istanbul amid fears of attacks on non-Muslims during Christmas and New Year celebrations. A 38-year-old Lithuanian national has been charged with the murder of a man in Ipswich. The formal cause of death has yet to be established, though the victim was found with head, neck and facial injuries on Tuesday morning. More than 160,000 people are expected to fly out of Heathrow today, even though it's still quieter than the days around it. Across the industry, the Civil Aviation Authority says airlines have been preparing for the busiest December on record, with 22 million people flying last December. And with chilly conditions across much of the country this morning, we're just hearing a white Christmas has been declared in Jersey. The Met Department on the Channel Islands says snowflakes this morning make for the third white Christmas since records began, the first since 1970. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
On DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker. Christmas on Times Radio. Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
The Royals with Roy Anika and Kate Manzi on Times Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Royals from The Times and The Sunday Times with me, Kate Manzi.
And me, Roy Anika. Almost every Christmas since 1932, people across Britain have gathered around radios and TV sets at 3 o'clock for one thing, the monarch's Christmas message. Today is no exception.
It's a rare moment where every year the sovereign steps out from behind ceremony to speak directly to the nation.
And since George V delivered that very first broadcast, the message has become the monarchy's most deliberate act of communication, a chance to set the tone, offer reassurance, and gently signal the values the crown wants to project in the year ahead.
But this year, that message won't land in a vacuum. The monarchy is closing out 2025 under immense pressure.
The scandal surrounding Andrew Mountbatten Windsor has reignited questions about accountability, privilege, and trust, just as support for the institution hits a historic low.
But of course, this isn't the first time a Christmas message has landed amid royal turmoil.
From the fallout of Annus Horribilis to the aftermath of Diana's death, the Christmas broadcast has always been more than just a message. It's a test of judgment, tone, and timing.
And all of this sits on top of a deeper challenge. In an age shaped by transparency and social media, do the old rules of royal messaging still work? Should the Christmas message be on TikTok, not TV? To help us answer these questions, we're joined by someone who's been thinking, writing, and reporting on the monarchy for decades.
Peter Conradi is Europe editor for The Times and The Sunday Times, and author of royal books, including The Great Survivors, How Monarchy Made It Into the 21st Century, has it, Peter? And The King's Speech, which tells the true story behind the events shown in the film with the same name, which no doubt is showing somewhere this Christmas.
Peter, welcome to The Royals.
Thanks very much. Pleasure to be here.
Great to have you.
So, Peter, today we're asking this. What can the monarch's message achieve in a year like this? How has the royal message changed, or has it not changed quite enough as the world moves on around it? And crucially, what does the king need to say in what might be his most important broadcast to date?
Now, Peter, you've been foreign correspondent, Europe editor, biographer, cultural commentator. But what is it about the monarchy that draws you in again and again?
I suppose, as so often happens with journalism, I got into writing about monarchy rather by chance about 15 years or so ago, but became fascinated by it. I suppose not so much by the sort of day-to-day, week-by-week stuff that both of you cover so well. Although, you know, I obviously read all these twists and turns just like any other avid news consumer. But, you know, in my case, rather the institution of monarchy itself and how it functions. And I mean, that means in historical sense, how the monarchy has evolved over the years, I suppose over the centuries. But also my current job as Europe editor of the Sunday Times, also looking at Europe's other six other monarchies, which we Brits often forget actually exist, about how they function, I suppose, and the differences and the similarities with our own, which means also looking at the way that they've survived and how the majority of others that we used to have in Europe haven't. And doing all that from the vantage point of Republican France, where, of course, they got rid of their own monarchy rather messily during the revolution, brought it back for a bit, got rid of it again, and then rather wish, or rather a substantial minority of them, rather wish they still had it.
Peter, you recently wrote a fascinating piece for us on the Sunday Times about the pressures facing the monarchy and looking at European monarchies as well. When you look at the sort of turbulence that the Windsors have been through this year, how do you compare it to other periods of choppy waters that we've seen them go through over the decades that you've reported on?
Look, this has obviously been a very, very difficult year, most obviously because, as you say, the deepening scandal surrounding Andrew Mountbatten Windsor. And it's been all the more damaging because it's come at a time, I think, where the institution itself seems to have been suffering one of these periods of fragility that we see over time from year to year. So, you know, it got through the death of the late Queen in September 2022 remarkably well. You know, at the time, there was sort of some speculation that some of those other 14 countries, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, and so on, who also have our monarch as their head of state, would, you know, take that opportunity of the change of reign to peel away. You know, that hasn't happened. And I think the current Queen, Camilla, has also been accepted by the people as a whole in a way that, you know, would scarcely have seemed possible at the height of Charles's battles with Diana back in the 1990s. But there's no getting away from the fact that the late Queen was obviously a very, very difficult act to follow. And I mean, part of that, I think, was just because she'd been just 25 when she came to the throne. By the end, she'd been there for 70 years. Charles, by contrast, he was already 73 when he became king, which meant, obviously, he wasn't sort of young and fresh and exciting and appearing to inaugurate a new era. But he also didn't have the sort of the benefit of incumbency. So it's, you know, it, in a sense, wasn't his fault, but all, you know, these two factors were against him. And then, obviously, in early last year, we had the announcement first of his diagnosis of cancer and the Princess of Wales's diagnosis of cancer, which, thankfully, both of whom seem to be a lot better now. You know, so you look at the royal family in crisis, but then we've got to bear in mind also that it has a habit of getting into crises and overcoming them. I mean, most obviously, the abdication of Edward VIII in 1936. So the expectation is it'll do so again.
Well, that's really interesting. You talk about the kind of general fragility. It's always going to be a bit of a fragile time, I suppose, in a new reign, particularly after such a record-breaking reign as the previous one. But let's turn, first of all, to the Andrew Mountbatten Windsor crisis, because the messaging around this has dominated much of the royal news this year. And there were two moments, I think, that really kind of crystallised it. Less than a fortnight apart, we had two different statements which showed messaging both bad and good. On Friday, the 17th of October, the palace released the statement from Prince Andrew, as he was then, saying that he will, quote, no longer use my title or the honours which have been conferred upon me, saying that he had decided to put duty to his family and country first, although there was no admission of some of the ordeal that some of the women had been through with regards to his former friend Jeffrey Epstein.
But that statement just did not cut the mustard. It did not do the trick, because there was a clamour for the king himself to take much more action, much stronger action. And then we had that second message from the palace, this time on the 30th of October. And the tone was clear, it was much stronger, and it said, His Majesty has today initiated a formal process to remove the style, titles and honours of Prince Andrew. And interestingly, the emphasis is not on the royal family or the duty to the country, which had been in Andrew's previous statement from himself, but the emphasis here in a statement from the palace, not Andrew, was on the victims and survivors of any and all forms of abuse. And as I later found out, all the previous statements that had been put out, courtiers had tried to put something in there about the survivors, about the victims of abuse, and every time those statements had gone to Andrew for sign-off, he'd taken that out. And this time, the King and Queen said, enough is enough, we are going to mention the victims here. And I think that was a game changer.
And also the difference as well of the final thing being stripped from him, that prince title. In between those sort of 2 weeks, there was a lot of public discussion, obviously, about him no longer being Duke of York and the fact that it seemed that he had voluntarily given up those titles. But that wasn't enough, was it? And we saw real kind of public outpouring in that 2 weeks. There was a lot of discussion in Parliament and among MPs in general, both in the House of Commons, outside the House of Commons, about what should be done.
I thought it was quite interesting. So, you know, allies of the king tried to say, when I asked them about it, because I read that first statement on a Friday night and just thought, that is the worst fudge I've seen come from the palace for a long time, and that will not work. Sure enough, it didn't. And then in the ensuing couple of weeks, allies of the king tried to say, well, he had to take his time. He wanted to see the mood of the nation. He's now seen the mood of the nation and he's acted. Actually, he just got it wrong first time round.
Well, there were constitutional issues as well, weren't there, that they were trying to figure out. They were seeking legal advice behind the scenes in those 2 weeks to figure out how and if they could remove that prince title, which is designated at birth and is actually sacrosanct in law, according to George V had written down. The fact that if you are the son of a monarch or grandson of a monarch, you are entitled to that prince title. So there was an issue about, okay, how do we rip up the rule book? And that was what was going on, I think, as well, behind the scenes. What did you make of that first statement, Peter, and then the subsequent one, if you like, which was the sort of sucker punch from the palace, really the king speaking directly to the people?
I think it does sort of fit into this sort of unfortunate tradition, I think, of the royal family appearing, or the monarchy in Britain appearing to sort of react too slowly to everything, to be almost sort of leaving it till a moment too late to react, not to do it all in one fell swoop, to do it gradually. And I think that's something that we've had in the past, and I think it's ultimately quite damaging.
Do you think one big statement would have been far better and straight from the king to say, you know, I've ousted him? Was it not an opportunity for Andrew to kind of quote unquote do the decent thing for once?
He's not known for that, though, is he? And he wasn't this time round either.
I mean, that's,
but we must say that he's, you know, he's always denied any allegations of wrongdoing.
He has. But in terms of your point, was it the opportunity for him to do the decent thing? The very fact that he thought he could get away with clinging onto his titles and then being in abeyance shows you he doesn't know what the decent thing is in terms of messaging and not showing any sympathy or remorse for the victims.
I think just, you know, in general, you know, PR terms, I've not been in PR myself, but I know plenty of people that are. And it's always a matter, I think, of being proactive, not being reactive. And there's a danger, I think, that the palace always comes out looking a little bit too reactive.
In terms of, you know, putting it in context of crises, and you talked about the monarchy is known for going into sort of periods of crises and then pulling itself, you know, taking off again and pulling itself out. We had in 1992, the Queen described that year at the end of the year as her Annus Horribilis, didn't she? Because we had, obviously Charles and Diana's marriage was starting to very visibly crumble. We had the separation of Fergie and Andrew. We had, I think, Princess Anne separated too. Not a good year. And of course, we had the fire at Windsor Castle. We then, in 1995, we had Diana give her explosive panorama interview. Kate and I talked about that quite recently on the podcast with Andy Webb, and all the extraordinary implications and the domino effect after that, which, you know, led to their separation, their divorce. And then 2 years later, the seismic explosion of Diana's death and the ripple effect that had on the monarchy in terms of, well, what we can talk about messaging there. How do you put Andrew Mountbatten Windsor's scandal, ongoing scandal, how do you sort of place that in terms of historical context, in terms of just how bad it has been for them?
I think it's bad because if one looks back at the Annus Horribilis 1992, it was essentially, you know, three out of the Queen's four children's marriages breaking up. Now, you know, that's, you know, it's not such a shameful thing for a marriage to break up. A lot of people's marriages break up. Again, Diana's death in 1997 was a great tragedy. There were concerns about the way that the royal family had handled it initially. But again, you know, it was something, it was, you know, a tragic accident. Here we have a much more damaging scandal potentially, because it goes really to the heart of the monarchy, and it sort of overlaps. It's not just a personal matter. It's not just private. But I think, you know, there's a more fundamental problem with monarchy, with royal families, in a sense that, you know, if you compare it with an organization, if you compare it with, you know, they used to call themselves the firm. I don't know if they still do. If you look at any firm and you've got a member of that firm who is behaving badly, you know, you sever links with them, you find a way of doing it, you get rid of them, they're nothing to do with you anymore. The problem with royal families is that you can never completely sever links with someone because they're part of the family. Yeah. And that's, you know, that is the fundamental issue. I think that not just they, but other European monarchies, who I think we'll get onto in a moment, who've had a, you know, their fair share of scandals, have also found that you can, you know, someone will always be the king, so the son, the daughter, the brother, the sister of the monarch. And there's no getting away from it.
So when you look at the kind of the pressure, the scrutiny and the public mood around the family as a unit, like you say, what themes do you think a Christmas message from the king could possibly address in a year such as this one?
I mean, he's obviously not going to dive into the Andrew problem, is he? That is not going to be in the Christmas broadcast.
No, but it's going to be the elephant in the room, isn't it? So how do you talk about family togetherness at a time when
he's not invited to Christmas and they're keeping him as far away from Sandringham as possible?
You know, we've seen him out riding in the rain while the rest of the family are invited into Buckingham Palace for lunch.
We know that the whole family who spend Christmas Day with the King and Queen at Sandringham all after lunch gather around to sit and watch the broadcast with him. Everyone except Andrew, who's not going to be doing that because he's not going to be there. So anyway.
What would you advise the King to say in his Christmas message?
If you did work in PR, Peter, which we know you don't, but if you did. As a wise owl who's observed monarchies for decades, what would you advise King Charles to say to get around the elephant in the room?
Oh, goodness me. I mean, he is damned if he does and he's damned if he doesn't, isn't he? I mean, that is the problem. I mean, what an elephant it is. I suppose, you know, we mentioned earlier that 1992, that the so-called annus horribilis, when everything appeared to go wrong. I mean, so what happened on that occasion? On that occasion, I mean, interestingly, the Queen didn't repeat the phrase annus horribilis in her Christmas speech.
Well, that was the Guildhall speech, wasn't it?
It had stuck by then.
She kind of cleared it out the way, didn't she, before the Christmas message, which was quite a smart way of doing it, really.
Mm. Yeah, and I mean, what she did was that, you know, I was looking back at her words, and I mean, what she said was merely, like many other families, we've lived through some difficult days this year. So people watching that would have said...
Understatement of the century.
precisely. So she didn't kind of go into the personal stuff of her children's marital breakups. And I mean, again, in 1997, which was... So 4 months after Diana's death, obviously she had to speak about Diana's death and she could mention Diana's death directly. She had to mention Diana's death directly. But she also kind of coupled that with her and Philip's golden wedding anniversary that had also fallen that year. And again, looking back at what she said, then she spoke about the shock and sorrow mingled with happiness that she and Philip had experienced. So, you know, there's always, there've been attempts in the past, not so much to relativize things, but to, I don't know, kind of soften them a little bit. And I suspect that they will attempt something similar this year, but I think we will hear very soon.
If we look at briefly the three messages he's done so far, what he's talked about in 2022, the first year of his reign, it was very much, you know, there was the sort of referencing of his mother. He did it from St. George's Chapel, Windsor, paying tribute to her, you know, where she's buried. And he talked about community hardship and the generosity of volunteering. 2023, he was at Buckingham Palace overlooking the Victoria Memorial. And that again was all about volunteering, the environment, shared values in a global conflict, echoes of Ukraine-Russia conflict there. And last year we had a real break from tradition. He was at the Fitzrovia Chapel. It was a rare break from recording the broadcast at a royal residence. Obviously that was a year that in which he'd announced his cancer diagnoses, both him and the Princess of Wales. And he talked about, he paid tribute to healthcare workers who had supported him and who support so many others. And I think this year, given we've just had that address to the nation that he's just done for Stand Up to Cancer, delivering that news that his treatment's going to be reduced in the new year. He's not in remission yet, but
he said it was good news, didn't he?
Good news and a personal blessing. I think there's an opportunity for him, again, to talk about, you know, the good news, the good health news,
the importance again of early screening. I suspect he'll pay tribute to healthcare workers again. I think that'll be possibly a big point of his speech, and it'll be an optimistic one.
Yeah, and I think that, well, he can't ignore either some of the speeches that he's given in those three inward state visits, where he's talked about, you know, increasing challenges around the world. You know, that seems to be a kind of recurring theme of the year with, you know, Russian invasion of Ukraine, that the aggression continues. I think, you know, he has talked a lot about this year. I wouldn't be surprised if he decides to, you know, talk about the challenges we face as a kind of global community.
Possibly using clips of our European allies that have been here, the German president, Macron.
Speaking of those inward state visits, which, I mean, we've had
Trump.
Three this year. We, yeah. You know, it's the first time in decades that we've had three inward state visits. They've all been very important, all been at Windsor instead of Buckingham Palace. I mean, what would your crystal ball say, Peter, with regards to what the king should or could say?
European togetherness will be in there, maybe? A little bit of...
Oh, I think that's always a bit sensitive, isn't it? European togetherness. But I think between the two of you, you've actually done a much better PR job than I could have done on suggesting what he could talk about. So, you know, he could, as you say, sort of as the starting point of his, not complete recovery, but he's certainly doing much better health-wise. I mean, yeah, I mean, no one is going to complain if he starts saying positive things about the National Health Service, about health generally, about caring and that kind of stuff. You know, maybe he might then, you know, conceivably find a way of just avoiding this elephant, the Andrew elephant that we were talking about, and might just, you know, not mention it at all.
You won't mention it.
You know,
he mention it? How can he mention the former Prince Andrew and former Duke of York in a Christmas message? He just, that would be a buzzkill, Christmas buzzkill, and he won't do it. How would he do it?
Well, I bow to your superior knowledge. I suspect he probably won't, but he will get a lot of
adverse press. If it was, that's what we'd all be writing about.
I think he's hoping everyone will, you know, they won't forget, but I think he's hoping people on Christmas Day will not be thinking about Andrew Mountbatten Windsor.
But for many people sitting around, it's a family tradition. People put the television on. It's a kind of cosy Christmas Day, part of the Christmas Day celebration. But for monarchy, it's something far more deliberate, isn't it? I mean, it sets the national tone and the values for the year ahead. And it's a rare point of direct communication, which we don't see very often. We see him talking to members of the public and we report on that. We talk about statements that he's given. You know, we've mentioned the one about Andrew. And apart from the Stand Up for Cancer message, we don't see him that often directly addressing the nation, looking down the lens of the camera. This is a kind of a moment in which he can speak directly to his people, if you like. 2026 is going to be a big year, isn't it? I mean, we've got the 250th anniversary of independence in America. If you look back to 1976, the late Queen went out to America to help them commemorate that. And it's expected that we will have a member of the royal family going out to President Trump's USA to help them mark that. Obviously, his health continues and he'll hopefully be, you know, looking ahead with sort of bright prospects. But you've written in depth about the King's speech and how these speeches sort of come about. Tell us a bit about that. You know, the George VI radio broadcast was a rally to the nation in 1939 after Britain declared war on Germany. So how has the Christmas message evolved historically, Peter, from what you know, and what role has it played in those key pivotal moments for the nation?
I think in a sense it's remarkable how little the speeches have changed. I mean, the accents have become considerably less posh over the years. I mean, if one listens to one of the late Queen's early broadcasts and contrasts that with one of the more recent ones in the years leading up to her death, you know, she sounded almost like a different person. But I think, you know, the overarching message, I think, has remained the same. It's sort of, you know, mildly, not overtly religious in tone, sort of intended to cast the monarch in the role of the head of a great family, which, you know, back in 1932, when we had the first speech, it was an address not just to the United Kingdom and to, you know, the 14 other countries that we have now that have the king as their head of state, but also to the empire as it was.
Join us after the break for more from Peter, Kate and me, Roy Nika, with our look ahead to the King's Christmas message here on Times Radio.
The Times and the Sunday Times Christmas Charity Appeal 2025. This Christmas, the Times and the Sunday Times are supporting Switchback, The UK's prisons are understaffed and overcrowded, so the rehabilitation of prison leavers is more vital than ever before. Switchback provides mentoring and practical education to male prison leavers to support their rehabilitation. To find out more and donate to any or all of our nominated charities, search Times Charity Appeal now. Thank you.
Christmas was a tough time in my family. I became homeless as an adult. I had to turn to a food bank.
This Christmas, your gift to Trussell could help provide emergency food and expert advice. For people like Aaron, it'll be a lifeline.
This Christmas, my dream is that people leave the food bank with hope.
If you can, please give to Trussell today. You can help food banks provide an emergency food parcel and support someone facing hunger this winter. Search Trussell today.
Here's to the moment, to the places that give you perspective and the people that change that perspective. Embrace limitless discovery on a Silver Sea voyage with savings of up to 40%. Book between December 3rd, 2025 and February 28, 2026 at silversea.com. Here's to having every reason to celebrate, to finding more. Terms and conditions apply. Selected voyages and fare categories. For full terms and conditions, visit silversea.com/limitlessdiscovery.
It might be mid-winter, but there's nothing mid about this offer. The new Samsung Galaxy S25 Ultra brings every winter sport moment to life as crisp as freshly laid snow. With its stunning 6.9-inch dynamic AMOLED display, razor-sharp resolution. But here's the real win. Claim £250 cashback. Conveniently available to spend in your Samsung wallet. Purchase before January 29th from a participating retailer. Claim on the Samsung website within 30 days of purchase. T's and C's apply.
At Aberdeen Investment Trusts, we create more ways for your money to work harder. Whether you're looking to tap into global markets or target specific goals at any stage of life, we have options for you. With Aberdeen, our investment knowledge and experience become yours. Search Aberdeen Investment Trusts online to learn more. When investing, please remember that your capital is at risk.
Issued by Aberdeen Fund Managers Limited.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. Christmas on Times Radio.
Merry Christmas with the news on Times Radio. I'm Laura Cook. The King and Queen have led members of the royal family into the traditional Christmas Day service at Sandringham. Crowds gathered since early this morning for a glimpse of them. Princesses Beatrice and Eugenie are among those attending, even though their parents, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor and Sarah Ferguson, haven't been invited. The revelations haven't damped the enthusiasm of fans who've travelled to the Norfolk estate, though. These women, who came from Texas, believe the royals will emerge stronger.
I think the steadfastness will see them through. I think they have a great example coming from the Queen. Life is full of hills and valleys, and you pick yourself up and you keep going and find the courage. So I think they're doing great.
Pope Leo has highlighted the conditions for Palestinians in Gaza. The US-born pontiff made an unusually direct appeal in his first Christmas sermon at the Vatican. He said the world's conflicts could only be silenced through dialogue.
The word has pitched his fragile tent among us. How then can we not think of the tents in Gaza, exposed for weeks to rain, wind and cold, and of those of so many other refugees and other displaced people on every continent?
Donald Trump has promised not to let a bad Santa infiltrate the US. The president also suggested a stocking full of beautiful coal may not be bad, while quizzing children about what Christmas presents they wanted. A Lithuanian man has been charged with murder after another man was found dead at a house in Ipswich on Tuesday morning. A post-mortem's found the victim, who was in his 30s, had injuries to his head, neck and face, though no formal cause of death has been established. Arvidas Maliusis, who's 38 and from Norwich, is due in court tomorrow. A national award for bravery will be given to those who were first on the scene of the Bondi Beach terror attack. 15 people were shot dead 11 days ago when two men opened fire. One civilian, Syrian-Australian Muslim Ahmed Al-Ahmed, was wounded as he disarmed one of the terrorists. Australia's Prime Minister Anthony Albanese said recognition is important.
At the same time as we've seen the worst of evil and the worst of humanity, we have seen the best of humanity. The bravery and kindness and compassion to fellow Australians that we saw from those who rushed to danger.
A helicopter has crashed on Africa's highest mountain, killing all five people on board. The aircraft was on a rescue mission to pick up patients from Mount Kilimanjaro when it came down there. Two foreign nationals, a doctor, a tour guide and the pilot, all died. Tanzania's Civil Aviation Authority has begun an investigation. And there are warnings for cold and windy weather in southwest England and parts of Wales, while Jersey's Meteorological Office says snowflakes have been spotted, giving the Channel Island its third white Christmas since records began. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
On DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker. Christmas on Times Radio. The Royals with Roy Anika and Kate Manzi on Times Radio.
Welcome back to this look at the King's Christmas Message with me, Roy Anika, and Kate Manzi, the royal editors of the Sunday Times and the Times. And we're looking at what the King might talk about in this extraordinary year. And also talking with Europe editor Peter Conradi about the history of the royal address to the nation.
If one looks back at why George V made this first broadcast in 1932, it was the idea of Sir John Reith, who was the then Director General, founding figure of the BBC, who had just launched what was called the Empire Service, which is now obviously known as the World Service, that had been launched 6 days before Christmas that year. And, you know, they'd been asking the king for some time to make a broadcast. The king hadn't been enthusiastic because he thought he didn't really take radio very seriously. He thought it was about entertainment and wasn't a serious medium and so on. But he finally agreed as part, in a sense, of the launch of the Empire Service. And it was all about, you know, the idea was using this new technology as a way of binding together the hundreds of millions of subjects of the empire, and as you know, the inauguration of the radio service, and you know, and it remained a one-off. This speech that George V apparently delivered, sitting at a desk under the stairs in Sandringham, reading out words that had been written by Rudyard Kipling, it resurfaced again only under his son George VI in 1937. Now George VI, famous for his stammer, as we saw in the film The King's Speech, you know, he took over from his brother just before Christmas in 1936, but he managed to dodge doing a speech at all that year because he was, you know, only been a few days in the job and he said he wasn't quite ready and so on. But there was no getting away from it in 1937, when he made the speech for the first time. Again, 1938, he ducked out of it. And it was only in 1939 and from 1939 onwards that he made the speech.
That global reach that you've touched on, Peter, that the sort of evolution of it from what was the Empire Service then became the World Service. When it's packaged up by Buckingham Palace, the Christmas broadcast is described officially as the King's address to the nation and the Commonwealth. That is how it is described, that is how it's pitched. And it is as much opportunity for him to reach his millions of subjects in his Commonwealth nations as much as it is here. And I think, just going back to your point, that there was so much trepidation around reign change in terms of this expectation in some quarters that realms would suddenly start to derealm. We've had so many Caribbean nations say, oh, we're going to, you know, cut ties at reign change. Well, none of them have done it. None of them have done it, predictably, because referenda are very unpredictable. They all say they're going to do it in their manifesto. They never get around to doing it. So for him, it's a sort of way of, shoring up the international audience, the Commonwealth nations, to shoring up the monarchy brand around the world as much as it is a nice, cosy tradition for Brits here.
And not even although it's specifically for the Commonwealth around the world, there are other countries as well at play. Of course, you know, I'm sure the US president will be watching. You know, I'm sure that message will go out to people in America. So this is a golden opportunity.
He'll be watching because he wants to see how many pictures of himself are in there on the state visit.
He's surely got to be included, hasn't he? I mean, this is it, isn't it? This is brand Britain. It's an opportunity not just for the monarch to deliver his thoughts to his subjects, if you like, if that's not too antiquated a term, but it's an opportunity for him to talk about, you know, to put brand Britain all around the world and to make those kind of coded messages about how allies are important and all those things.
Yeah, I mean, it is indeed. And I mean, so in that sense, it hasn't really changed an awful lot since George V in 1932.
Although I suppose, you know, you look at Queen Elizabeth II modernising the format, taking it more personal, making it for television, of course, more reflective, perhaps, you know. We sort of joked at the beginning of the programme, didn't we, about it being a, you know, a future TikTok or something like that. But that, you know, it's changing, it's morphing. You've got to address a generation for a different era. I mean, how did you see much change, or do you think that it's quite stayed in its format and needs to remain as such?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can look back. I mean, so it started on radio, and then in 1957, for the first time, it was on television. And that was, you know, the royal family had been reluctant to have it on television because at the time it was recorded live and it was seen as kind of intrusive, you know, having television cameras interrupting their Christmas day. That was something that was echoed by George VI that came out for sort of the research I did for the King's Speech book, which was that, you know, he would talk to Lionel Logue, his speech therapist, who himself had to always go up to either Windsor or Sandringham, wherever the king was, to make his Christmas broadcast. And the king would, you know, complain to him about how annoying it was to have to, you know, finish lunch and go and make this broadcast. And he didn't feel that he could properly relax, he could properly celebrate Christmas until he got it out of the way. These days it's you know, it's not done live. It doesn't need to be done live. But you're right. You know, formats have changed. We had the transition from radio to television. And now we've long since had the tradition from television to first just to the internet, then to social media and so on. So, yes, there is a, you know, there is a need to modernize in that sense, to modernize the medium that's used. You know, and I wonder how many 20-somethings who are not sort of sitting at home with their parents or with their grandparents or whatever. I mean, if they were sitting on their own, would they actually say, oh, it's 3 o'clock, I must turn on the television and see what the king's got to say? And I fear not many, because they probably, perhaps they don't even have a television to start with.
Well, I suppose that's why they're now reaching out to different audiences, isn't it, through social media. So we look at the Princess of Wales this year, launched her season. So with every season, she narrated a little video and put that out on her social media channels. So you had the King on Channel 4 on a Friday night talking about his cancer and you know, sharing some quite personal revelations. Okay, we still don't know what type of cancer it is. We still don't know what type of treatment publicly that, you know, he's had. But can you see that kind of morphing? Do you think they need to do more of that? Like you say, you know, a lot of Gen Z aren't going to be putting on, you know, traditional TV channels at 3 o'clock on Christmas Day in their own homes, unless perhaps they're with granny or other relatives.
But they might be streaming Apple TV Plus and watching William on his scooter zooming into Windsor Castle to have a chat with Eugene Levy to talk about changes on my agenda, Eugene, and all of that. That's very strong, new, much more modern messaging, isn't it?
The King too, I suppose. He's got his Amazon project coming out next year, his big Harmony film, another giant streamer that you wouldn't expect. It's not the traditional BBC Dimbleby route, is it?
No, so, I mean, you know, that they are embracing these new technologies. And I think, it is a challenge for them, or particularly for their advisors, to decide what is appropriate, what isn't appropriate, you know, what they'll come out looking good from and what they'll just sort of end up looking ridiculous doing. But it's probably not that different from the challenge that the politicians face as well. You know, we've seen, or maybe we haven't seen, Sir Keir Starmer's TikToks, I think, which I understand are not the most riveting. You know, other politicians are better at them. You know, it's really a difficult balancing act, but everyone in the public eye faces it.
Well, it is a balancing act, isn't it? I mean, how much of yourself do you give? How much do you maintain? And the mystique is interesting. So in your piece in the Sunday Times, you referenced an infamous 1969 documentary called Royal Family, which was broadcast back at the time and then rebroadcast that year in place of a regular Christmas message. So this really showed for the first time the late Queen inviting the cameras behind the scenes. And we saw, you know, Prince Philip barbecuing. We saw, you know, in a way, a much more wholesome kind of family that you know, apart from just the staged kind of public events. I mean, what did you think about that? Was that a mistake for the royal family? Was it was it a good idea for them to open the Pandora's box? And how much of the kind of daylight, as they say, you know, do they let in on the magic of monarchy?
Yeah, I mean, in retrospect, that was absolutely extraordinary. I was old enough, I was 9 at the time, I think, when it came out. I can't say I remember watching it, but I suppose I could have done. But looking back on it, looking at the decision, I mean, to screen this documentary, it was all absolutely extraordinary. So the catalyst for the broadcast was the then Prince Charles's investiture as Prince of Wales in July of 1969. And broadcasters around the world wanted footage of him from the palace. And the problem was that, you know, he hadn't actually done very much at that stage. So there wasn't an awful lot of footage that could be supplied. So the decision was taken to make a film that looked more broadly at the monarchy and at the royal family, at their role, you know, what they did. And I think it was also part of a feeling then, as perhaps now, that, you know, things were changing, the world was changing. This was the 1960s. It was, you know, much more the swinging 60s. We weren't in the buttoned-up 50s anymore and so on. And that they weren't quite in touch with that. And, you know, interestingly, Prince Philip was a great, great modernizer, something maybe it's a bit forgotten these days. And he really played a driving role in organizing this whole thing. I mean, if you look at it now, it's almost like an early version of reality television.
There was, I mean, it gave so much access to them, didn't it? It was unprecedented access to them. And actually, I mean, the general feeling is that most of the royal family, including Prince Philip, the great modernizer who pushed for it, came to really regret it. Because not only was it then pulled very quickly, you can't watch it now. It's incredibly hard to get hold of that documentary. It's sort of been wiped from all records. And you quoted in the piece that there was a quote from David Attenborough, who at the time was the BBC's director of programmes, and he accused the maker of the royal family, Richard Causton, of, this is the quote, killing the monarchy, because the whole institution depends on mystique and the tribal chief in his hut. If any member of the tribe ever sees inside the hut, then the whole system of the tribal chiefdom is damaged and the tribe eventually disintegrates. And the late Queen, very soon after that broadcast went out, came to the same conclusion. I think she felt it had let way too much daylight in on her family. And once you open that door, you can't really close it. But she tried to close it by removing the documentary from the records. So they dipped their toe in the water of access, you know, in 1969. And I think very soon felt they'd gone way too far.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it was broadcast on BBC and then a week later it was broadcast on ITV. And I think something like 2/3 of the population of Britain watched it. And once you've seen something, you can't unsee it. And I think it did, you know, in the longer term, it did change people's perception of the monarchy. It sort of blurred the distinction between private and public. And I mean, you know, there's one argument you could say, the increasing intrusiveness that on the part of the media that followed in the 70s, 80s, and particularly in the 90s when Diana came on the scene, you could say, you know, in a sense, perhaps the royal family brought this on themselves through opening themselves up in the first place, or, you know, or maybe all that intrusiveness would have happened anyway. But it's, you know, it's a very, very important episode in their history, I think.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? I mean, you look back at some of a lot of this footage is available on YouTube and old interviews and things like that. There was another interview that Charles did in 1969 around the time of his investiture. And he was incredibly open. They're sort of asking him about his childhood, he revealed that he'd found out that he was Prince of Wales aged 9 by sitting in the headmaster's study at Cheam School and sort of being bemused by it because his mother had sort of neglected to tell him she was about to announce that. And then the investiture obviously happened when he was 21, by which time he knew a bit more about it. But we don't see those interviews in that way as frank anymore. We don't have the access that we perhaps once did. And maybe this is a reaction to seeing how it can all unfold like that. But it's much more controlled. But there does seem to be now a sort of slowly, like we mentioned, the Eugene Levy on Apple Plus with William and his scooter at Windsor Castle, King Charles. We're going to see him in 2026 in the Amazon documentary Harmony about his projects, and there'll be some time with him in that. You know, it does seem to be that they're now trying to renegotiate that relationship with the media. I mean, what do you think, or how do you see that playing out? Do you think that's a good idea, Peter, to try to kind of move with the times, or are you seeing it as a sign of a family that's been burnt in the past by poor mistakes?
No, I mean, I think obviously they have to move with the times, or they'd still be just doing everything on radio. So, you know, that's clear. And there is this kind of relationship between the royal family and those such as yourselves that cover them on a regular basis. You know, you sort of both need each other, as it were. And clearly from the point of view of the royal family, of the monarchy, you know, they want to do things on their terms. They would like to release, exactly what they want to release. They would like to control what they release. And obviously your job is to find things that they don't want to release, and to report them. And so there is always this kind of battle backwards and forward. And I think, you know, regardless of which medium or media it plays out in, that's the inevitable result of covering the royals in any way. And I mean, maybe in the past, you know, as recently, I suppose, as the 60s and the 70s, there was still a very deferential attitude on the part of the media towards the royal family. And so perhaps in those days, it was much more the royal family that were dictating, and the members of the press or media were merrily writing down what they were told or broadcasting what they were given and so on. You know, obviously we're not in that kind of age anymore. People are far, far less deferential. The media are far, far less deferential. So, you know, the balance has shifted, but it's still this kind of, push and pull between the two that, I mean, you both probably know far better more about how that works than
well,
I do.
Peter, that's it, isn't it? I mean, when we pull it all together, the scandals, the scrutiny, the history, is the message actually keeping up with the moment? Because in your piece, you look at that sort of sliding scale. It's the graph, isn't it, that shows that popularity of the monarchy is down, you know, lower than it's ever been before. You know, we've seen kind of little peaks with the jubilees of the late Queen, but actually it's going in one direction. The latest research published in September, before Andrew was deprinced, if you like, shows only about half the country now thinks Britain should remain a monarchy, 51%. So support is falling faster among younger generations as well, where Republican sentiment is becoming the norm. I mean, how are they going to turn the ship around?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is actually very, very dramatic. I mean, it's strange. There is this every year, this National Centre for Social Research, every year since 1983, they brought out a report asking essentially the same question. And, you know, the latest report that came out in September was barely noticed by the media at the time. I must say, I certainly missed it completely. But it shows that, you know, support to the question, should Britain remain a monarchy? When they asked that question in 1983, 86% of the population said yes. When they asked it again in September, as you said, a mere 51% said yes. I mean, that is a huge long-term decline, and a pretty alarming decline, I think. And that was before Andrew. And even more alarming is when you look at it on a break it down on a generational basis, you look at people 16 to 34, something like 6 out of 10 of those would like to have an elected head of state. So a majority of under 34s want an elected head of state. Then you look at the over 55s, 3/4 of them want a continuation of the monarchy. So I suppose there are two questions, or there are two possibilities. One is that as those young people get older, they get more fond of institutions and perhaps they become a bit more monarchist. I mean, that's presumably what...
That'll be the monarchy's hope, won't it?
That's what they hope. The reality, I think, is that as they get older, they keep that same opinion, and you see a further decline that, you know, at this rate, if we go another 40 years, we could be down to maybe, you know, 30% support. And I mean, how long can a monarchy endure if it's, you know, has so little public support?
Well, one of the points you made in your piece was you looked across the pond to European monarchies, which look and feel very different to ours. They're much smaller. Do they have some lessons that the Windsors can learn from in terms of evolution and going forwards?
Yeah, I think some lessons, but I mean, you know, I mean, one should certainly not think that everything is perfect on the other side of the channel when it comes to monarchy. I mean, there've been some enormous scandals in some of the European countries that make, you know, Andrew Gate, as I'm sure it'll be called at some stage, look, you know, pale into comparison. I suppose what the monarchy facing the most problems is probably the Norwegian monarchy, where we have the crown princess Mette Marit, so the woman who's going to be the next queen of Norway. Her son from a previous relationship is going on trial in February for a number of very, very serious offences, including several counts of rape, which he, we should make clear, he denies. I mean, you know, that, if, imagine that were happening in Britain. I mean, that is a mega crisis. We've had Juan Carlos, the former king of Spain, who a decade or so ago had to resign because of a mixture of kind of personal and financial improprieties, I suppose we could say. You know, so there have been problems. We shouldn't think that everything works perfectly, but they, you know, they are, let's say they're not as lavish as our monarchy. I mean, our monarchy, I think, costs about £500 million a year, it's been estimated. Theirs are all considerably cheaper. And, you know, no, they don't live in social housing. They all have palaces. They do royal things. They have crowns. You know, they look royal. You know, they satisfy all those kind of criteria. But they don't have quite as many palaces as ours do. They don't have, you know, quite as lavish budgets or so on.
They're royal light.
They are indeed.
So back to the Christmas broadcast, finally. What does everyone, what would you like to see or hear the king say? If there's one thing you'd like, one point you'd like him to touch on or theme you'd like him to go at, what would it be?
I think it would be refreshing. I mean, we expect the king to talk a bit about his personal cancer battle and throw it open, I think, to other people going through. And I think that is really important. I think he does need to acknowledge that it's something that touches every family in the country, and, you know, both here and abroad. And I think it would be really nice for him to acknowledge that and the fact that it is something that we all need to come together to help with cancer research. I think it would be refreshing for the king to talk about some of the struggles other families are going through. You know, this has been a year in which, you know, we've had a budget which has been quite controversial. Lots of people are feeling the pinch. And I think for the monarch to acknowledge some of the struggles that are happening in families across the country would be really timely.
We did talk about the cost of living crisis a couple of years ago, didn't we? So it might be timely for him to do that again.
Yeah, I think given that, you know, we're talking about, Peter's been talking about, you know, European royal families being cheaper. You know, there's a big discussion that's going to be had in 2026 by the Public Accounts Committee about how the property deals are done between members of the royal family and the Crown Estate. We're going to be looking again at public finances for the royal household, and that's going to be a big issue coming up. So I think perhaps if the King might be quite wise to just acknowledge some of the financial strains that families are feeling. And I think that would be interesting. But of course, as well, he's going to look at the global picture, I'm sure, to talk about the international challenges we all face.
Peter, what would you like to hear from him?
I think, just sort of taking up those points, really, I think it would be, you know, I don't live in Britain. I live in France, but I come back to Britain a lot. And I, you know, my impression is, maybe from talking to people, but also from reading the media or so on, that there is quite a lot of negativity around at the moment. And I think that anything that he can say to sort of bring people together, to kind of cheer people up even, I think would be very, very welcome indeed, to sort of say, well, actually, you know, things are not as bad as everyone says. You know, yes, there's a cost of living crisis. Yes, a lot of people are suffering financially at the moment. But, you know, let's look at the positive. Let's look at, you know, the great things that Britain has to offer. You know, it is and remains, whatever political problems it may have, you know, a great country to live in. And I think one shouldn't lose sight of that. So something a bit upbeat, something a little bit positive.
Big up the UK.
And what about you, Roy? What do you think?
I would like to see him find a way to acknowledge what so many people feel at Christmas, that Christmas can be a really trying time with your family. It's not always picture perfect.
And he knows it better than anyone.
And that goes the same for his family as well as everyone else's families. And I think if there was a clever way for him to acknowledge that, people would go, well done, King Charles. I don't think he will, but it'd be nice to see him try.
So our thanks to Peter Conradi for joining us for such a thoughtful and interesting conversation.
That's all from us for this episode of The Royals. We'll of course be watching closely as the King delivers his Christmas broadcast, and we'll be back in the new year to unpack what it all means.
Until then, thank you for joining us, and Merry Christmas to all of you from us here at The Royals.
Merry Christmas!
Local, national, global, there's always an election, and politicians are always thinking about the next one.
The smell of victory is the thing that actually makes it worthwhile.
On How to Win an Election, we've assembled a crack team of strategists who've all been at the top political table for both the good times and the terribly bad.
In the end, that is what a Prime Minister does.
Every week, we answer the big political questions.
Are we living in Morgan McSweeney's government or Keir Starmer's?
Listen to How to Win an Election wherever you get your podcasts.
Cancer Research UK is funding the breakthroughs that matter. Did you know that over the past 50 years, their work has helped double cancer survival in the UK? Cancer Research UK science expert Dr. Sam Godfrey talks about the breakthroughs that could change the lives of people affected by cancer.
One of the breakthroughs that I'm so excited about is that our scientists discovered that the human papillomavirus actually caused almost all cervical cancers and a number of other cancers too. This has meant we've been able to develop a vaccine, and that is now expected to prevent almost 90% of cervical cancers in the UK. With screening as well, we think we're going to get to a point where we can stop almost all cervical cancers, and we're going to see a future where cervical cancer is effectively eradicated. It's such an exciting thing, and it just scratches the surface of what really is the golden age of research.
Witness more incredible research breakthroughs in Cancer Detectives Finding the Cures, brought to you by Cancer Research UK. Stream now on Channel 4. Cancer Research UK is a registered UK charity.
Unfold a world of on-the-go entertainment with the Samsung Galaxy Z Fold 7. The massive 8-inch main screen means you'll see the bigger picture as every exciting moment unfolds. Share every highlight and keep the whole family entertained wherever you go. Buy yours now and claim £300 cashback. Conveniently available to spend in your Samsung wallet. Purchase before January 29th from a participating retailer. Claim on the Samsung website within 30 days of purchase. T's and C's apply.
Here's to the moment. To the places that give you perspective and the people that change that perspective. Embrace limitless discovery on a Silver Sea voyage with savings of up to 40%. Book between December 3rd, 2025 and February 28th, 2026 at silversea.com. Here's to having every reason to celebrate, to finding more. Terms and conditions apply. Selected voyages and fare categories. For full terms and conditions, visit silversea.com/limitlessdiscovery.
You're listening to Times Radio on Christmas Day. Coming up, Fee Glover chats to the actress Miriam Margolyes. Before that, with the time approaching 3 o'clock, a special Christmas message from His Majesty the King.
A few weeks ago, the Queen and I were delighted to make a state visit to the Vatican, where we prayed with Pope Leo in a historic moment of spiritual unity. Together, we celebrated the Jubilee theme, Pilgrims of Hope. Pilgrimage is a word less used today, but it has particular significance for our modern world, and especially at Christmas. It is about journeying forward into the future, while also journeying back to remember the past and learn from its lessons. We did this during the summer, as we celebrated the 80th anniversaries of VE and VJ Day. The end of the Second World War is now remembered by fewer and fewer of us as the years pass. But the courage and sacrifice of our servicemen and women and the way communities came together in the face of such great challenge carry a timeless message for us all. These are the values which have shaped our country and the Commonwealth. As we hear of division, both at home and abroad, they are the values of which we must never lose sight. For instance, it is impossible not to be deeply moved by the ages of the fallen, as the gravestones in our war cemeteries remind us. The young people who fought and helped save us from defeat in both world wars were often only 18, 19, or 20 years of age. Journeying is a constant theme of the Christmas story. The Holy Family made a journey to Bethlehem and arrived homeless without proper shelter. The wise men made a pilgrimage from the east to worship at the cradle of Christ. And the shepherds journeyed from field to town in search of Jesus, the Saviour of the world. In each case, they journeyed with others and relied on the companionship and kindness of others. Through physical and mental challenge, they found an inner strength. To this day, in times of uncertainty, these ways of living are treasured by all the great faiths and provide us with deep wells of hope, of resilience in the face of adversity, peace through forgiveness, simply getting to know our neighbours, and by showing respect to one another, creating new friendships. Indeed, as our world seems to spin ever faster, our journeying may pause to quieten our minds, in T.S. Eliot's words, at the still point of the turning world, and allow our souls to renew. In this, with the great diversity of our communities, we can find the strength to ensure that right triumphs over wrong. It seems to me that we need to cherish the values of compassion and reconciliation, the way our Lord lived and died. This year I have heard so many examples of this, both here and abroad. These stories of the triumph of courage over adversity give me hope, from our venerable military veterans to selfless humanitarian workers in this century's most dangerous conflict zones, to the ways in which individuals and communities display spontaneous bravery, instinctively placing themselves in harm's way to defend others. As I meet people of different faiths, I find it enormously encouraging to hear how much we have in common, a shared longing for peace and a deep respect for all life. If we can find time in our journey through life to think on these virtues, we could all make the future more hopeful. Of course, the greatest pilgrimage of all is the journey we celebrate today, the story of the one who came down to earth from heaven, whose shelter was a stable, and who shared his life with the poor and lowly. It was a pilgrimage with a purpose, heralded by angels, that there should be peace on earth. That prayer for peace and reconciliation, for doing to others as we would have them do to us, which rang out over the fields near Bethlehem more than 2,000 years ago, still reverberates from there and around the world today. It is a prayer for our times and our communities too, as we journey through our lives. So with these words and my whole heart, I wish you all a most peaceful and very happy Christmas.
DAB Digital Radio, on the Free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker. Christmas on Times Radio. Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the Free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
Off-air Christmas special with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
This is Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio with a festive special. Now, settle down for the next 2 hours because we'll be reminiscing on our favourite interviews from the past year. And coming up, we've got some stellar guests, including Jerry Halliwell, Gary Newman and Nicola Sturgeon. But first, Miriam Margolyes, a force of nature. At 84, her age is in no way dimming her ability to accept the challenges her varied career is offering her. I got the pleasure of interviewing her back in September about her new book, The Little Book of Miriam, which is an alphabetical compilation of the workings of her mind, her anecdotes, and her philosophy of life.
It's chunky and perfectly formed. Like me. Okay. And I'm really thrilled with it. I get a physical satisfaction from holding it and stroking it.
Do you?
I do. I honestly do. This is actually the first book, you see, because it was sent to me as soon as it came out, as soon as it was printed, because I had to have a look at it. And I was almost in tears with excitement. It really was wonderful because, you know, it looks good. And I love the wit of having me just because I'm very small. I mean, I'm as broad as it's long, practically, you know.
Well, I think it really does the trick and it stands out in a bookshop as well, which is obviously what we're hoping.
We're very much hoping so, yes. I stand out in a bookshop a bit too.
Yeah. We've got so much to talk about, Miriam, because, I mean, it's called The Little Book of Miriam, but there's absolutely blooming everything in there, isn't there? So
I thought I would put everything in there because I want people now to know me in my entirety. I think because I know everybody knows that I'm naughty and foul-mouthed and quite funny, but I'm also tender and sympathetic and kindly, and I want that side of me to be on view as well.
So what do you think you've told the reader about that side of you that you've not revealed before?
Because it's not chronological, it's alphabetical, I've been able to concentrate on shorter anecdotes that put forward the things that I'm interested in. So I think that is different. It's not just about me from A to B, it's about me from A to Z. And it is Z, it's not Z, because I'm not an American.
No, let's always stick with the Z. I learnt lots of lovely things about you reading through the book. I am fascinated by your current domestic setup, and under L for lodgers is a lovely little passage describing how you live in London at the moment. So can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, well, I have an intergenerational house, which for someone who has no children is quite brave, because it's all right having your children with you because you know where they've been, mostly. Well, maybe not.
Not so much.
But I have half of my house because I can't climb stairs anymore. So I decided I'd have lodgers on the top bit of my house, which is a beautiful house, actually. So I didn't want to put a lift in, because I could have put a lift, and then I'd have been able to get everywhere. So I've got two lodgers. One is male, one is female. One is straight, one is gay. They're both working, which is lovely. And they love each other. They really get on. And George bakes gorgeous cakes. And Emily has fabulous conversation. And she's working in television and is very intelligent. And George is an actor. And he's so gifted. So we have a lot in common. And I learn from them. And they learn from me, because I'm quite open about my life and what I believe in. And they're just charming and sweet and kind.
They must have thought that their lucky penny had turned up when Miriam Margolyes invited them to live in her house. I know that, I don't want to obsess on a kind of frisky detail, but I know that they do come in and help you with your underwear, don't they? They help you with your getting your bra on.
Yes, bra duty is a solemn business, actually. It's a bit like compline, I suppose, but the bell rings in the morning and the bell rings in the evening to go on and to go off. And I don't mind who does it because I can't reach the back because I haven't worked out how to do front bras. There are people who have bras that do up at the front and I could probably manage that. But the bras I need a little bit more uplift than front bras. And so I do require help. And I just say, bra duty, and one or other of them pops down to help me.
This is fantastic. Is it true that this is all being developed into some kind of a TV show that we'll be able to watch?
It is. They won't be playing... Well, Emily won't be playing herself. George will be playing himself, I insist. And I don't think anybody else could play me, so I'm going to do it. But they may find somebody better. But yes, it is. And I think it'll be quite heartrending, really.
I think it'll be fantastic. Is it being filmed at the moment?
Oh, no. It's still, what do they call that? In development.
Right.
Okay. Yes, I wish I'd known that phrase when I was young.
Just constantly saying, yes. I'm in development. Yeah. You do say in the book, though, that you're getting a little bit fed up of living in London and actually New Zealand tempts you in some way.
It's so beautiful and it's gentle and it's quiet. And you know, as you get older, you do need a bit of quiet. I love raucousness and activity, but I do need to rest sometimes. And I think the beauty that you look at and the gentleness of the people and the wonderful Maori stuff, that is incredible. I've got to know a few Maori people, and they are quite special, and their history is remarkable, and their music and the haka. I mean, I went to a rugby match, which I loathe, can't stand rugby, but my word, when they, you know, even the girls do the haka, and it's, that is a bit thrilling, I must say.
So where feels like home? Because also you have a home, don't you, with your partner in Australia. So you're truly international. And so if somebody says, you know, you return to your valley, where do you think of as being your valley?
I want it to be Italy now. I'm going to give up Australia because it's too far away and Heather doesn't drive. And the village is just that bit too far for her to get to. So I think we're going to sell it, which is going to be very sad. But Italy is, for me, the place.
OK. Please don't go too soon.
No, I won't. And I'll always keep a place in London, because you have to if you're in the business, you know. You've got to do that.
Can I tell you off in a very...
Oh, I love it.
Affectionate.
Are you going to spank me as well?
That's later. So, under I for intelligence, you say the following in your book. I once described myself as extremely unintelligent, but I no longer think it's sensible for me to say that I'm extremely unintelligent. I can't do IQ tests. I'm completely innumerate, for example, but I can remember telephone numbers. So perhaps a more accurate self-assessment would be that I'm a little bit thick. Now, Miriam, you're not thick. You're not unintelligent. And when I read that, I just thought, no, don't say that about yourself. To retain the information that you have in your head, to know all the Dickens stuff that you do on stage, to have performed all the parts that you've performed, you are a super intelligent woman.
No, I don't accept that for you. I don't actually think I'm stupid, although I can be on occasion, of course. But I really do have difficulty with intelligence tests. I can't cope with them. You know, when you have to put shapes into other shapes or something like that. I just think, well, I don't see where the join is. I can't do it. And that is a bit anxious making, because that's how they decide when you should go into a home, isn't it? So
yeah, but you've got so many other forms of intelligence.
Yes, I'm good at people. I'm very sharp at people.
How many onions are you on a day at the moment?
Well, I try to get about two or three in. I like an onion with a mackerel pate. That is thrilling. And I do have onion at breakfast, if I have breakfast. But I met an absolutely terrific taxi driver this morning, and he said, I don't have breakfast. No, you don't want to. You've got to fast. I said, I was fasting before you were born, which I certainly was true. He said, no, fasting is the way, you know, because I said, I'm 84 and I'm still fat and it's stupid. And people sometimes ask me, what would you say to your younger self? And I would say, lose weight.
Are you tempted by the injectable weight loss drugs that are available now?
No! That is horrifying. First of all, it's supposed to be for people with diabetes. Well, that, I mean, you shouldn't be using medicine that is needed by other people. There's a worldwide shortage of Ozempic. No, I certainly wouldn't.
What do you think the path in life would have been for a very thin Miriam Margolyes? Is that a different path altogether?
You can't tell, can you? You can't push back what happens. I honestly don't know, but I think that I would have possibly been richer earlier. I'm rich now, but it's taken a while. And perhaps I would have been richer earlier, and I might have had more sex.
Okay.
Because people, you know, somebody, Norma Mitchell, God rest her soul, she actually said, well, I would have gone to bed with you, but you're too fat, you know. So, I mean, there's nothing like telling someone.
There's only one, Miriam Margolyes, and that book, The Little Book of Miriam, is out now. She is remarkable, isn't she, actually, Miriam? Now, am I right in saying that you had a little bit of a family link to Miriam?
Oh, Miriam's father was a doctor, and my grandfather, my mum's dad, was a doctor, and they knew each other in Oxford.
There we go.
And my mum went to the Oxford High School, where Miriam Margolyes was too. So, I mean, we're practically family, Jess.
Yes. Yeah, well, it sounds like it. Gary Newman is not in any way, as far as I know, connected in a family way to Fee Glover, but he is a pioneer of electronic music, the dad of synth pop, and he's sold millions of records. Hits, of course, like Cars and Our Friends Electric, a turbulent career, actually, after he shot to fame in his early 20s. He joined us back in July to talk about the release of a live album recorded at Wembley.
The fame thing, when that first happens and all that comes with it, I mean, you've read a lot about it as you're growing up. You know, that's why you want to do it. You know, you want to be in a band and play music and become famous and all of the trappings of that. But most of the things that I'd read, they miss out so much of the other side of it, you know, the baggage that comes with it. So you go into that with that sort of wild-eyed dream, sort of pretty naive, really. I did. Anyway, for sure. I don't know if the Asperger's adds to that or helps in any way. I'm not sure. But so it wasn't what I expected at all. And it sounds, again, it sounds ungrateful and childish to have become that successful and find something wrong with it, you know. But I did. I did not enjoy it. I did not like there is so much weirdness that comes with it, you know, death threats and all sorts of things. And it's just... And the press were horrible, very, and it was tarnished on almost every level. So I realised that it wasn't doing me any good. You know, whatever sort of mental health things that were going on, it was doing me no good at all. And so the idea to get away from it, I think, was a really sensible idea for somebody that young in the middle of everything. I mean, I had no manager. I was on my own, so to speak. And I think to realise what was happening to me and realise where it could go and how bad it could get was a really, really smart thing, really smart thinking in the middle of all that chaos. And so the idea to pull out when I did Wembley, I think was a really sound move. You know, it was a very surprisingly mature thing for somebody that was actually quite immature at the time. The way I did it was where the immaturity showed.
Why? Because
I make a great big thing about it. You know, I should have just done it. Should have just shut my mouth up, quietly stepped back, taken the time I needed, you know, reevaluated everything. Do I really want this? Is it really worth going ahead with it? I just wanted to become a better songwriter. I thought I'd been really, really lucky. You know, Arthur and Electric was the first number one, and that was actually two songs bolted together because I couldn't finish either of them, so not particularly high quality songwriting. And Cars, I'd been to London and bought a bass guitar to learn to play bass better, and the first four notes of Cars were the very first four notes I played when I got the guitar out. Didn't plan that. You know, it just fell at my feet, really. You know, so I couldn't take any kind of credit for being talented. I didn't feel talented at all. I just felt incredibly lucky. And so I wanted to learn how to do what I was supposed to be doing, the songwriting part. So I wanted to do that better. And so I needed time. I needed to get away from all the chaos and all the weirdness and just step back from all of that and just concentrate on being at home, writing songs, getting better at what I was supposed to be doing. And that's why I did it. The mistake was saying I was going to do it.
Why were the press so hard on you?
Oh, I don't know. You know, it's such a long time ago now. It's 46 years ago. I think electronic music was very new, and a lot of people didn't take to it. They saw it as a threat to guitar dominance. They saw it as a change in music that was unwelcome. I was the first of the big stars, I suppose, to come along. I was the first one that had massive success with it. And so I think all of that hostility that they felt towards it, which did change over time, but initially all that hostility was directed at me because I was the biggest one at the time. You know, and I think a year or two later, when other people have come along who were every bit as good as me, if not better, and had success, people started to accept it more. And so the hostility that they had to endure was way less, if any at all. But for some reason, it stuck with me. But I think that my Asperger's probably played a part in that. You know, I probably could have handled it so much better if I'd have been more...
God, Gary, I think you're being so hard on yourself, though. I mean, you were very young, and as you say, you hadn't got a manager around. And also, I mean, I understand what you say about how you'd read about being famous and, you know, the trappings of it and stuff like that, but nobody can possibly know, can they, what it feels like until they're actually in it and whether or not they are the right kind of person to deal with it.
I think it's learning, like a lot of things, you have to learn what's good and what's not so good and learn how to navigate that, you know, how to find more time for the things that you enjoy in it and how to navigate through the bad bits. There's like my two of my children now, my eldest and my middle, Raven and Persia, that they are both heading this way. You know, Raven's already had singles out. Persia's at a music college now. And I'm not worried about them coming into it. Well, I am a little bit, actually, if I'm truthful. But because I've been through it all myself, for, you know, almost my entire life, they've got somebody right there that can help with that same navigation problems that I didn't have anyone to help with. And so, it's difficult. You know, when you read about being famous, it sounds amazing, doesn't it? It sounds really, really good. You know, everyone knows who you are and there's lots of money, supposedly.
Well, was any of it good?
Yeah, lots of it. Lots of it was really good.
You must have met fantastic people.
Yeah, I met some that are fantastic and some that were a disappointment.
Oh,
yeah.
Who was a disappointment?
No, that's not, fair.
But it's
I'm
also,
sure I am to lots of people.
No, you're not. Yeah. You're not. I can tell we're going to have to build you up here, Gary. That's our job. And it's the truth, though, isn't it, that things might be very different now because certainly in terms of your relationship with fans, we've seen Lewis Capaldi do that recently where he needed to go away and have some time to himself. He had to leave the stage, yep, literally. But he's got methods of telling people that now. You can talk to people on social media. You can actually confess where your head is, I think, an awful lot easier and expect some sympathy, rightly, for that.
Is there
a bit of you that thinks, God, if only I'd been this later?
No, not at all, no. I think social media is 90% evil. I mean, it's just an awful burden on all of us. I'm thinking about that only today, actually, on the way here, that I wish it wasn't there. I do. So it's social media is no comfort whatsoever.
Do you think it can connect you to your fans?
If you mention anything on social media about anything, you could say the nicest thing and there's somebody will find a problem with it. You know, I don't even have feedback on my social media anymore. It's all turned off. No comments. Don't want to hear. There's too many idiots out there, too many weird people that just feel they've got to say something horrible. So, no, I'm glad it happened when it happened and I didn't have to have the whole social media thing falling on your shoulders. I sympathise with people today. How many people have killed themselves? They've got a little bit successful. You know, they've been on one of these reality TV shows or something, and suddenly the onslaught of people descends upon them and they go to ruin. It's common, but it happens fairly too often.
That is true.
I didn't have any of that. You know, I had people writing me nasty letters, which I didn't bother to read. You know, so I think I got off lightly compared to what people have to go through now.
The fantastic musician Gary Newman discussing his latest album, the live album, recorded at Wembley. You're listening to Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio. Coming up, more of our favourite interviews from the year, including another icon, Jerry Halliwell, no less. First, let's get the latest from the Times Radio newsroom.
Boxing Day Breakfast with Rosie Wright on Times Radio.
After Christmas Day on the Western Isles with the McDonald's, Callum hands the baton to me, Rosie Wright, for Boxing Day Breakfast. I'll be on hand alongside four generations of the Wright family, helping you to digest and decompress after all that excess, whilst keeping you across the news, of course. See you then.
Boxing Day Breakfast with Rosie Wright, tomorrow morning from 7 on Times Radio.
I am so looking forward to Christmas. I absolutely love everything about it. Decorating the tree, wrapping the presents. For us, it's always been a big family get-together. Me, Mike, the kids, my sister Julie, and all her family too. We all go back home to Mum and Dad's house. It's a bit of a squeeze these days, but Mum and Dad are both in their 80s now, and it's really important that we all go where we've always gone for Christmas. It just wouldn't be the same any other way. Thankfully, this year we have Carol, Mum and Dad's lovely care professional from Home Instead. Home Instead are amazing. I honestly don't know what we'd do without them. Carol comes and visits in the week when we're all busy at work and makes sure that Mum and Dad have everything they need. Obviously, this year we've all offered to help with preparing the Christmas dinner, but Mum absolutely insists that she's got it all under control. Which means Carol has.
For award-winning home care you can trust, go to homeinstead.co.uk.
Here's to the moment, to the places that give you perspective and the people that change that perspective. Embrace limitless discovery on a Silver Sea voyage with savings of up to 40%. Book between December 3rd, 2025 and February 28, 2026 at silversea.com. Here's to having every reason to celebrate, to finding more. Terms and conditions apply. Selected voyages and fare categories. For full terms and conditions, visit silversea.com/limitlessdiscovery.
Across the UK, on DAB, online and on your smart speaker. Christmas on Times Radio.
Merry Christmas. With the news on Times Radio, I'm Laura Cook. The King has used his Christmas message to put communities first and urge the nation to never lose sight of the Second World War values of courage and sacrifice. His Majesty also referenced the impact new technologies can have on well-being and community cohesion as the world spins ever faster. He suggested the festive period might be a moment to recharge and for those communities to grow stronger.
Indeed, as our world seems to spin ever faster, our journeying may pause to quieten our minds, in T.S. Eliot's words, at the still point of the turning world, and allow our souls to renew. In this, with the great diversity of our communities, we can find the strength to ensure that right triumphs over wrong.
Meanwhile, the Princess of Wales was inundated with well wishes as members of the royal family went to their annual Christmas church service at Sandringham. The Pope has called on Ukraine and Russia to hold face-to-face talks on ending the war. Leo XIV asked thousands who'd gathered for his Christmas blessing in St Peter's Square to pray for what he called the tormented people of Ukraine.
May the clamour of weapons cease, and may the parties involved, with the support and commitment of the international community, find the courage to engage in sincere, direct and respectful dialogue.
Moscow says it's reviewing a fresh US-backed peace plan. Kyiv's offered to withdraw troops from the country's east if the area gets special economic status. Emergency service has been called to a beach in Devon following concerns about people in the water. Search efforts are underway at Budley Salterton with a number of people brought to shore safely. Christmas and Boxing Day swims in the southwest of England have been cancelled this year because of a yellow weather warning for wind. Two men have been arrested on suspicion of a Christmas Day murder. A 30-year-old man was stabbed to death at around 3:30 this morning in the Moseley Village area of Wolverhampton. West Midlands police say the suspects are 35 and 58. And a British online campaigner affected by US sanctions has launched a legal battle against deportation by Donald Trump's administration. Former Labour adviser Imran Ahmed, who's the chief executive of the Centre for Countering Digital Hate, said he was proud to call the US my home. Mr. Ahmed was one of the group of people involved in campaigns tackling disinformation who were hit with visa sanctions, as the US Secretary of State Marco Rubio accused them of leading efforts to coerce American platforms to punish American viewpoints they oppose. And Scotland international and Nottingham Forest legend John Robertson has died at the age of 72. The winger was instrumental in winning the European Cup with the Midlands club in 1979, then scored the only goal to retain the trophy the next season. And for News Bulletin, when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
On DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker. Christmas on Times Radio. Off-air Christmas special with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
This is Jane and Fee on Times Radio, looking back on some of our favourite interviews from 2025. Now, earlier this year, I got the chance to sit down with Dame Joanna Lumley and talk about her new book, My Book of Treasures, a personal anthology of writings, poetry and wisdom from the actress and national treasure. In an effort to get to know Joanna a little bit better, I started by asking her more about her iconic husky voice.
Well, I'm 112 now, and I think my voice has come down. I mean, I did make an effort, because I think I know from recordings, when I was younger, it was higher and it was a bit further back. And I knew that that probably wouldn't last. And so I thought that it had to be sort of trimmed down a bit. So now, like an old smoker, I'm like this fee.
Yeah, well, tell me about the fags then, love. There is a lovely piece that you've included in the book, and we'll come on to the choices of the book in a moment, but it's an essay that David Hockney wrote in defence of smoking.
He's so funny and so candid. What I love about Hockney is he's rather like his paintings. It's literally that there's no artifice to any of it. It's just blazing and open and funny and humane, really. He's just saying, really, all this panicking about smoking, about the people who die from smoking. He said, what about the people who die from not smoking?
And he makes a very good point that he's had three doctors who've told him not to smoke and they're all dead. You and smoking, though. I mean, I think if we conjure up an image of some of your recent work, you're a fag and out your mouth all the time. Yeah. But is it true that once on set you fainted because you'd had to smoke so much during the takes?
What I had to do was I had to run downstairs on the set. This is in front of an audience, because we recorded All Absolutely Fabulous live in front of an audience. I had to run downstairs swearing about a taxi driver, which I'd, because he wouldn't have smoking in the cab. And I had four cigarettes in sticking out there. And Jennifer, Adina, lit them. And Patsy was sucking like this, inhaling. So I lit four cigarettes simultaneously. And that was funny and everything. But one of the cameras was in the wrong place. And they said, could you do it again, please, Joanna? So then I had to go back and say, come back. And I was crazed with dizziness. I could hardly see. I thought it put me off smoking for a whole day.
Do you still smoke now?
I do, but not a lot, but I do.
Okay. Yeah. Do you worry about that?
No, not remotely. Also, I'm going to be 80 next year, and you can't go on forever. So, I'm fine. There's nothing wrong with me. And some people have got, some people die of stuff when they don't deserve it. And some people die of stuff and they might have hastened their life towards it. We are what we are, just do what you can and love life and be grateful.
I know that you've spoken before about feeling that the push for positive ageing at the moment is, it actually makes you slightly uncomfortable. Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Well, I don't feel as though I'm going to be 80, because when I was growing up, 80 was really great, great, great grandmothers were 80. And It seemed unfathomably old. It's a junior at baby school. We thought a woman who was, I think she's about 32, was just past it and pitiful. So it's very different, you know, whatever age you are. So if you're feeling okay and you're what you are, I think that might be positive aging. What I don't like is this idea that we've got to, all of us, try to live forever. That bores me to death. Anybody who says I'm going to be cryogenically preserved, they're cut straight off my dinner party list.
Okay. Mm. You do mention the early supper parties that you and a couple of girlfriends used to have in a flat in Earl's Court. It's a lovely inclusion in the book about the joy of boiled potatoes with tarragon.
Well, we were so poor. Four of us shared a two-bedroom flat on the top of an Earl's Court building. And we, not the Earl's Court building, a beautiful little building in Earl's Court. And we were all as happy as clams. One was a ballet dancer, one was a secretary, one was worked in an art gallery, and one was a model. That was me. And we had no money at all. I mean, I think I earned £8 a week. Rent was £4 a week. £1 in the kitty for food for the entire week. And £3 was left. Then you had to pay your agent, and then you had to pay tax. So I'd have about 4 and 6 pence. So you didn't have very much money. So what you lived on was nothing. We couldn't afford a fridge, so we put milk on the windowsills. We couldn't afford a cooker, so we rented one from the gas board. I mean, but we were as happy as larks. We did everything ourselves. And quite often supper was boiled potatoes.
Do you think that you would enjoy being that age now? No. As a modern young woman?
I'd be terrified.
Why?
Well, because none of this self-regard. I think that mobile phones and social media have encouraged people to look inwards and look at themselves all the time, reflect always on themselves. And that's the only certain way I know of becoming incredibly depressed. It's the worst kind of legacy of depression there is. And people are now astonished at what they call the mental health problem amongst young. It's because they're being encouraged to look at themselves and only themselves, regard themselves. That can't work, Fee. That's not the way forward. Forget about yourself. Look forward. Look outwards.
Is there a bit of you, as an older woman in the industry, that envies younger women being able to air their grievances about men? Because I know that, you know, you were not immune from hassle from older men when you were a younger model and actress.
You had a tougher skin then. You knew, you used to pass around messages, you know, that thing of not safe in taxis. And you'd know somebody, you'd go, don't be alone with him because his hands will be everywhere and things like that. But it was never a great drama, you know. I think men are men are men. You know, they've got different appetites. It's going to make me terribly unpopular to say this, but I do think men and women are kind of different, tend to be.
When you say different appetites, what do you mean?
Literally different appetites. I think that you can keep a camera crew, if they're men, happy by giving them some very good food. And so, for instance, in the French film industry, they would have a sit-down lunch every day, and the entire crew would sit down for a three-course lunch with bread and wine on the table and a starter and a main course and a delicious pudding, because that kept them happy and kept them going. Now, I think women can get by on a cup of coffee. I really do, because we're used to it. So I just think we have different paces.
Okay, so you don't mean sexual appetites?
I don't know. Who am I to say what anybody's sexual appetite is?
Tell us about these selections in the book, because they're so wide and varied.
Oh, well, look, Fia, I've been collecting things since I was about 12, you know, just save things up and stick them in the back of a book. But I use them as a bookmarker, cut it out. And then as I got older and had to do travel shows and things, I'd scribble things down, always carried a notebook with me, and still do to this day. But I'd see things in newspapers that I thought were fascinating. And I kept them. About 2-3 years ago, I did a book, a compilation book about the Queen, what people thought about the Queen, what they'd written about her, from very grand people to very humble people, through the ages, through her long, long reign. And the same publishers, Hodder and Stoughton, said, would you like to do another book, and might you have another think about something? And I said, well, look, I've been collecting all this stuff for so long, might that be useful? They said, have a go at it. So I printed every piece out separately, all the pieces I wanted. And then, of course, I was searching through. I thought, I know there's something I've written down somewhere, furrowing through, finding all these things. Print them all out separately and then assemble them into a kind of book form. And I wanted to sort of start and end with Dawn, because it seems to be an exciting time. But in it, there are bits that are funny, bits that are quite prayerful, quite somber, bits that are dug out from history. Some of it sounds quite grand, you know, the Essay on Man by Alexander Pope. But it's not grand if you read it. It's fascinating and good. Some of it, a tiny two-line poem by Spike Milligan or a quote from Stephen Fry. But then just funny bits and then just poems, because I love them.
And there are some lovely bits and pieces you've collected on the way throughout your career. I really enjoyed the stage directions. The
enchanting.
So there's one here on page 34, George Bernard Shaw from Passion, Poison and Petrification. I don't know whether you
he
could
says,
read that.
A thunderbolt enters the room. This is a stage direction. A thunderbolt enters the room and strikes the helmet of the devoted constable when it is attracted to the waistcoat of the doctor by the lancet in his pocket. Finally, it leaps with fearful force on the landlord, who, being of a gross and spongy nature, absorbs the electric fluid at the cost of his life.
That's so brilliant.
I mean, even to do that on a film, but on stage, how would you ever do that?
You've also introduced, I think, the reader to many, many wonderful things. And I think we're quite familiar with Nikki Haslam's list of things that are common.
Yeah.
But I hadn't come across the other list from Michael Bywater.
Who was one of my... Yeah. And he's just died recently, which is awful, and I'm so sad about that. I really admired him. He's a desperately funny man, and he's got a great insight, and he made a common list, and he said, for instance, it would be common not holding doors open for women, making a fuss about religion, referring to bodily functions, drawing attention to things, drawing attention to oneself, inability to hold one's drink, and it goes on down and down and down. It goes groping, burping, pushing in, whining, showing off, living beyond one's means. I love that. That's the thought of being rather common. Gobbling, shrieking, too much perfume, Brill cream.
But also going to the toilet.
Going to the toilet. I know. It's sulking, retching, flouncing. But it's just so funny. It's just the way we look at each other, Fee, in life and judge each other on what we do or don't do. And Nikki Haslam is just hysterical. I mean, he seems to revile everybody in the world, and I just know that all too soon we'll be on the list as well.
Oh, well.
Because he names people, doesn't he?
Yes.
He says people who just things he finds common, and people he finds
common. I don't think you'd ever be on the list, Joanna Lumley. I don't think you would. We don't have you for that much time,
yeah.
And that's absolutely our loss, but I'm sure it's your gain. You can go on to the rest of your day. But I did want to ask you about your campaign for the Gurkhas. It was so hugely important. To grant status in this country to people who had served this country.
Yeah.
And I just wondered, in the current climate around immigration, where you think that could have been a successful campaign now, or have times really changed?
You know, it's so odd, isn't it? Because that, I mean, already that was unfair back in 2008, 2009. Because Nepal, which is where the Gurkhas come from, has never been part of the Commonwealth. But the Nepalese soldiers, i.e. the Gurkhas, have always been part of the British Army for 200 years. They didn't have the same treatment as the Commonwealth soldiers did. And it was just literally unfair. I don't know whether it was a battle to get it through, but we did finally, Gurkha justice campaign, we got justice for the Gurkhas. But I wonder if that would be right now. I'm an immigrant. I was born in India. I've got my British papers signed at home to show that I belong. So I'm very wary of all this judging people. I think it's detestable. Our energy in the world should be, again, looking out. We should see why people have to leave faraway countries and prefer to come here. It's usually because of climate change has made their lands untenable, or strife and conflict and hatred and division has made their country unlivable in. And so why don't we all in this world try to make these colossal areas of the world safe to live in again, pleasant to live in? Why don't we have reverse osmosis and use desalination plants to water the desert so plants can grow, so trees can grow, so places can turn back to the forests they once were? Why don't we try to do that rather than setting up boundaries and walls to block people out?
Mm.
We're not thinking straight.
That is Dame Joanna Lumley talking about My Book of Treasures. Now, also this year, we got a visit from pop royalty in the form of Jerry Halliwell. She popped into the studio to talk about Ice on Fire, the latest book in her Rosie Frost series. Jerry told us a little bit more about the character of Rosie.
An orphan character is useful because they don't have the same boundaries, right? And absolutely, they don't have the same protection, so they're going to feel everything. But what the difference I try to make with Rosie is that to make her incredibly unairbrushed, real. You know, so there's lots of great orphan characters, but I thought, okay, let's make her as modern as possible. So, for example, she's grieving and you're going to feel her grief, but it's page turnery too. If you don't want to, you'll move on from it. But if you have experienced any grief, you're going to feel it through Rosie.
And do you mind me asking if you've had some grief in your life to tap into in order to write that?
Yeah, absolutely. I always think write about what you know as well. That helps. So the opening in book one, that was my experience. I got told, for me, it was my father, your father is dead. That opening scene in the classroom, that happened to me. I was studying Hamlet, and then that, ironically, I got told that. And the sort of the cold water numbness that I experienced was, I didn't know what, I couldn't even label the feeling. So I used that almost as fertilizer in Rosie's journey. In book two, it moves on to revenge, which is, you know, a universal feeling that we can all feel angry and want to like bounce into that. I call it the ricochet of revenge.
And she's chasing the story of what happened to her mother.
Yeah, she wants the truth, and she wants to punish somebody for it as well.
Yeah, it's impossible to read your books without constantly thinking how much of this is your personal experience of your life. I mean, that's natural with any author. There was one particular line, it's quite early in the book, where Rosie says, and I think it's advice from her mother, that silence is your greatest strength. And I did think, oh, that's interesting, because you are such a famous person. You could tell us so many stories if you wanted to. I bet in interviews there isn't a question you haven't been asked. So is that a bit of a motto for your own life too?
I think so. You know, I always go from our late queen. You know, there are times when we feel like, what do I do here? And I always look to her and think, what she handled her life so just with such good manners. I love that. You don't have to. Sometimes the most powerful thing is to say nothing and let the circumstances unfold. Even when we feel really like we want to like shout or blah, blah, blah. I just actually, if you look at her as such a great role model with grace and strength. And, you know, her life wasn't particularly, you know, like all of us, no one's asking for perfection. And I think sometimes, you know, we don't know the answers. So that was sort of leaning into that. You're absolutely right.
Do you come to interviews like this, though, with a sense of trepidation that, you know, the next question might be something that you don't want to answer?
Well, no, because I think everyone's allowed to have a questions, and but also if you stand in truth, your words have power. I you know, if I don't want to answer something, I won't. Mm. Do you know what I mean? But I'm actually, it's the opposite. I actually feel incredibly grateful. Like, if I'm honest, I woke up this morning a little bit tired, right? However, I was like, oh my goodness, I reminded myself, I'm so grateful to have this opportunity that it was a dream of mine. Okay, a dream of mine to be an author and write a trilogy and to be a successful one for people to embrace her. So for today, I get to champion something that I believe in, and I'm so grateful for that space.
You have also said that in future you would quite like to write something a little bit sexier. So Rosie Frost is aimed at the kind of 10-plus market.
Yeah.
You would like to do something a little bit more 50 Shades, is that
right?
I don't know.
I sort of said, you know when you say things like flippantly, and I don't know
and
if
I've
I meant...
I've read it, and I've asked it, and it'll carry on now.
Yeah, I don't know, is the truth. Right now, my head's in Rosie, and I'm working on number three.
And will you stop at three? Will it just be a trilogy?
She was always going to be a trilogy. I always say trilogy, that's my mother. Trilogy. And so whether there was prequels, I think the backstory, because I learnt in writing, and I was learning as I go, that you do what's called iceberging, that you really do really strong backstories for all of the characters. And I think that could be really interesting. There's so much history behind, you know, the whole of Heverbridge, where it's based, Heverbridge has got all the descendants of the Tudors, and Rosie's mother, Aveline, her backstory is really good.
Can I do the Spice Girls quickfire round with you, please?
Of course you can.
Will there be a reunion, and if so, when might that be?
I think, you know, on that, and that's a really good question, and I really respect the question, because, you know, I love the Spice Girls as a whole movement, a tribe of us, and the individual members. When we come to that conclusion of what it is, it comes from all of us, respectfully. That's
okay, so, yeah, you can't answer that singly. Would you like to record new material one day, do you think?
If it felt relevant, but if not, it doesn't. You know, it either way is okay, because I always come from a fan perspective. Let's say Madonna, right? I'm a massive Madonna fan. I would say I want to hear Holiday and Get Into the Groove, but I love Ray of Light. You know, have I connected to her later stuff? No, but she has every right to do that as an artist, if it's the relevancy. So if it felt relevant...
Then you would, yeah.
Yeah.
When you do all get together, do you immediately go back to some kind of template of how you were?
I think
you've all gone in such different directions, though.
Yeah, I think you have to respect that. In certain ways, it's like family. When I go to my mum's house, I can recognise I could have the same MO. You know, I could go back and literally open the fridge. I don't know what it is. As soon as I go back to my mum's house, I open the fridge. There's certain things. But then, you know, there's always an evolution of change and respect. But, you know, I really, really do just feel so proud of them individually and collectively.
Yeah.
You know, as individuals. I really do. I think they're amazing.
My colleague who I do the podcast with, Jane Garvey, we've been working together for years. We've written a book together. But people always ask us about our friendship. They ask us about how, you know, whether or not we've rowed, you know, whether or not we have bad blood between us, you know, that kind of stuff.
Why do you think they have?
Because there's something I think about female friendship.
Yeah.
That invites people to scrutinise it in a rather dismissive way, I think.
Why do you think that is?
I think some of it is a reflection of how our friendships in real life go. And
that's so interesting.
I think maybe we put on to other people what's going on in our local
That's so herd. Good. That's interesting, isn't
do you,
it?
Do you think that might be the case too?
That's really interesting and it could well be true. I don't know, but what I've come to the place of is really respecting that, you know, friendships are ebb and flows. You know, you come together and then you go in different directions and you come together, but there's always that a real friendship. There is always that love and respect that actually we might not have that. So our lives might look completely different and it might not be a day-to-day friendship, but there's always that absolute, you know, love and support that you think, you know, go you, well done you, and you want the best for them. I feel absolute pride and I'm like, wow, that's so brilliant. And I think that's what real friendship is about, isn't it?
I completely agree.
In completely different walks of life. But I have that in different, you know, I have a friend called The Ange and she's from Watford and I've known her since I was very, very young. But then I think as we get older, it's interesting, we can make new friends too.
What does The Ange do?
Let's pick the up Ange,
the Ange. She's an accountant.
Brilliant.
Right. She has an opinion.
Is she called the Ange outside of your friendship?
Yeah. I don't know. No, she's not. But I call her the Ange. And she is like very opinionated. She will have like very, I love her. She's so raw and real. She's such an, she's of paramount importance to me because her feet are on the ground. And she might not have the same opinions as me. And they're very, very strong opinions about, you know, a cross-section of things. But I love her for that. Mm.
That was Jerry Halliwell, pop superstar and now author. And Ice on Fire is out now. Still to come, we're going to be hearing from more guests, including Nicola Sturgeon and Nick Clegg. We turn political.
Global events.
How difficult is it for culture in Ukraine to thrive when the country's under assault?
Breaking news.
A crisis that has spiraled into the Middle East as competition for resources intensifies.
Reactive analysis.
We'll consider what's at stake for both leaders and our national politics.
From the world's best journalists.
Two people with different perspectives tell us what they think about today's events.
On DAB, online, on the app and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Simplify making tax digital for income tax with Xero. If you're a sole trader or landlord, you'll need to use HMRC recognized software like Xero to track your income and expenses, share quarterly updates, and submit your final tax return. Xero accounting software gives you a clear view of your financial picture, and with each quarterly update, you'll see your estimated tax bill, helping to avoid those nasty year-end surprises. Simply snap, scan, and sort receipts on your phone and on the go, so your records stay organized all year round, putting an end to the January panic and the piles of paperwork. With Xero, go beyond compliance and gain better control of your business finances. Your records stay up to date automatically, invoicing and payments run online, and a better view of your numbers helps you plan ahead. Less scramble at year end, more confidence all year. Change the way you see making tax digital with Xero. Search MTD Ready.
At Aberdeen Investment Trusts, we create more ways for your money to work harder. Whether you're looking to tap into global markets or target specific goals at any stage of life, we have options for you. With Aberdeen, our investment knowledge and experience become yours. Search Aberdeen Investment Trusts online to learn more. When investing, please remember that your capital is at risk.
Issued by Aberdeen Fund Managers Limited.
We interrupt your usual broadcast for something unexpected from Currys.
So Currys will give me £5 off eligible new tech if I bring in any piece of old tech.
Yep, we recycle it too, even if you didn't buy it from us. We call it cash for trash.
So can I bring in a broken kettle?
Yes.
A lawnmower?
Sure.
An iron?
Yep.
How about this? It's an iron lung.
There's someone in there.
Yeah.
Okay.
£5 cash for trash at Currys. Is it unexpected or just beyond expectations? GB only. Min spend of £25 to redeem. T's and C's apply.
Here's to the moment. To the places that give you perspective and the people that change that perspective. Embrace limitless discovery on a Silver Sea voyage with savings of up to 40%. Book between December 3rd, 2025 and February 28, 2026 at silversea.com. Here's to having every reason to celebrate, to finding more. Terms and conditions apply. Selected voyages and fare categories. For full terms and conditions, visit silversea.com/limitlessdiscovery.
Merry Christmas. With the news on Times Radio, I'm Laura Cook. The King has used his Christmas message to urge the nation to never lose sight in a divisive world of the Second World War values of courage and sacrifice and community spirit. In the wake of the Bondi Beach shootings and the Manchester synagogue attack, Charles also praised the spontaneous bravery of those who put themselves in harm's way to defend others.
The end of the Second World War is now remembered by fewer and fewer of us as the years pass. But the courage and sacrifice of our servicemen and women and the way communities came together in the face of such great challenge carry a timeless message for us all. These are the values which have shaped our country and the Commonwealth. As we hear of division, both at home and abroad, they are the values of which we must never lose sight.
Meanwhile, the Archbishop of York says he was intimidated by Israeli militias during a visit to the Holy Land this year. In his Christmas Day sermon, Steve O'Cotterill revealed he was stopped at checkpoints and told he couldn't visit Palestinian families in the occupied West Bank. He told the congregation the barriers people build around themselves are alarming.
We have become fearful of each other, and especially fearful of strangers or just people who aren't quite like us. We spurn our common humanity.
Pope Leo has highlighted the conditions for Palestinians in Gaza. The US-born pontiff made an unusually direct appeal in his first Christmas sermon at the Vatican. He said the world's conflicts could only be silenced through dialogue.
The word has pitched his fragile tent among us. How then can we not think of the tents in Gaza, exposed for weeks to rain, wind and cold, and of those of so many other refugees and other displaced people on every continent?
Two men have been arrested after a fatal stabbing in Wolverhampton this morning. A 30-year-old man was attacked in the Moseley Village area at around 3:30. Christmas on Sydney's Bondi Beach has been a more subdued affair this year following the anti-Semitic terror attack there 11 days ago. 15 people were shot dead after two gunmen opened fire on a Hanukkah celebration. Security has been tightened since, something these people have welcomed.
It's fabulous to see all the police too. They're doing a wonderful job and are very friendly.
I've been coming down here for nearly 40 years, Christmas morning. I think this is about regular.
Will we just pray today for peace and hopefully the future be brighter?
Australia's Prime Minister has announced plans for a National Bravery Award for those who responded to the atrocity. Thousands of jobs in the North Sea are safe as part of energy services firm Petrofac looks set to be bought. American company CB&I announced yesterday that it had entered into an agreement to acquire the firm's asset solutions business. The proposal transfers 3,000 members of staff to its own payroll when the deal goes through, which is expected in the first quarter of 2026. And England captain Ben Stokes insists they're fully focused on cricket despite a number of off-field issues going into tonight's Boxing Day Ashes test in Melbourne. The ECB are investigating reports of excessive drinking on the tour, while Jofra Archer is the latest player to have been ruled out with injury.
We need to make sure that we come together and make sure the focus is still heavily on the cricket, because after the last game we've still got a hell of a lot to play for. Very determined to leave Australia with something positive to look back on.
Australia already have an unassailable 3-0 lead. Archer's replaced in the team by Gus Atkinson, with Jacob Bethel in for Ollie Pope. And for a news bulletin when you want it, search for the Times News Briefing on any podcast platform.
On DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker. Christmas on Times Radio. Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and via your smart speaker.
Off-air Christmas special with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover on Times Radio.
You're listening to Times Radio. This is Jane Garvey and Fee Glover, taking you on a little guided tour of some of our favourite interviews from the past year. In August, Nicola Sturgeon released her much-anticipated memoir, Frankly, chronicling her life from working-class Ayrshire to becoming the First Minister of Scotland. Nicola spoke to me earlier this year and started by reflecting on the day her then-husband was arrested at their family home back in 2023.
I've had a torrid couple of years, and I probably don't need to go into too much detail about that because it's been played out all across the media. It's been, again, without being sort of indulging in too much hyperbole here, it's been the toughest couple of years of my life, with some really tested moments along the way. But I've emerged from it much stronger and actually much happier than I was before.
So it was 8 days after you resigned as First Minister that you got a rude awakening, 7 a.m, Scottish police force on your doorstep, and they arrested your husband.
Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
At that point, you, and I think this is very, it made me quite sad actually, you went to your mum and dad's.
I did. I mean, it wasn't my first instinct, it's probably quite a normal instinct. I suppose my first instinct was to protect them from what was happening. And I didn't really, in that moment, I didn't realise how ludicrous a notion that was, that there was no way I was going to be able to protect them because it was going to be headline, you know, almost global news within an hour or so. But I'd initially called my former chief of staff. She, as it turned out, had been at the gym, so she didn't answer the call. So I phoned my mum and dad, and with hindsight, I'm really glad that Liz hadn't answered the call because I ended up probably in the only place that I really needed to be.
What did you say to them?
I remember phoning them very quickly, telling them what was unfolding. My mum, it was my mum I spoke to on the phone, and looking back on it, I'm not sure how she managed to stay as calm as she did. But then, you know, I just got in a car and I got there, and I was in a pretty bad state. I think I was in a state of shock, actually, more than anything else. So, you know, but my mum and dad did what my mum and dad have done and what good mum and dads do all the time. They just, metaphorically speaking, kind of put their arms around me and, you know, looked after me for, I think I was there for 2 or 3 days before I went home.
It's slightly difficult for us to talk in detail about what has happened, because your husband, Peter Morrell, is awaiting trial on charges of embezzlement. The most recent headlines around this case have been about the fact that he has got legal aid. And I think some people have asked questions about this, and it would seem to be pure coincidence that the fact he applied for legal aid occurred after you'd announced your separation and therefore your own assets couldn't be included?
I can't answer questions that, because I'm not party to the application he made or the decision-making around that. And, you know, that's just how things are. Peter and I were together for a long time, but our marriage is over, and it had been over for quite a bit of time before I think we found, or I found, the kind of strength to announce it publicly, and that's just